feeling is being remiss.
Donald Trump, still a patient Sunday at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, where he is being treated for the coronavirus. His main doctor says that the medical team treating him is cautiously optimistic, but also notes that the president is not yet out of the woods. The latest assessment came from Navy Commander Dr. Sean Conley. Medical experts say the disease caused by the virus COVID-19 can become more dangerous as the body responds to the infection over time. In a video Saturday from his hospital quarters, Trump said he is feeling better and hopes to be back soon. Meantime, the White House is tracing a flurry of new infections among close Trump aides and allies. Attention is focused in particular on a September 26 White House event introducing Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett. There's a court vacancy now following the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. At this event, more than 150 people gathered in the White House Rose Garden, mingling, hugging, and shaking hands, mostly without masks. Among those who attended and have now tested positive are former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, former White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway, and two Republican senators. Well, while Mr. Trump is in the hospital, First Lady Melania remained at the White House to recover from her own bout with the virus. In that video Trump released, he said that his wife was handling her situation very nicely, joking that she is just a little tiny bit younger. In fact, she is 24 years younger than the president. Melania Trump celebrated her 50th birthday this year. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has shortened his scheduled trip to Asia after President Trump's positive COVID-19 test. Pompeo is fourth in line to succeed the president, behind Vice President Mike Pence and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This is VOA News. Tens of thousands of people marched through the center of the Belarusian capital Minsk on Sunday to demand that authorities free political prisoners, and police turned water cannons on them. The march crowned a series of rallies in Belarus since an August 9th election in which President Alexander Lukashenko claimed a landslide victory. His opponents say it was rigged to hand him a sixth term in power. The political crisis in Belarus has caused broad repercussions for Minsk and its ally Moscow. This week, the European Union and the United States imposed sanctions on senior Belarusian officials, but spared Lukashenko for now. Crisis has also raised the possibility of more sanctions against Moscow if it decides to help Lukashenko. Ruble has already dropped steeply at that prospect. Lukashenko denies electoral fraud and was inaugurated in late September in a ceremony held without any prior announcement, bringing more protests and condemnation from the EU, the United States, and Britain. Cambodia raised a U.S.-built building on its largest naval base to allow for further expansion, and will relocate the demolished facility, Cambodia's government said on Sunday, denying reports of Chinese involvement in the redevelopment. The Pentagon had said it was concerned about reports that the U.S.-funded Cambodian Navy Tactical Headquarters facility at Ream had been demolished and had asked the Cambodian government for an explanation. The building, roughly 100 feet long, had housed several small patrol boats. Cambodia raised the U.S.-built facility at Ream Naval Base for the building requires renovations. That's according to Prime Minister Hun Sen's office in a tweet. A small group of people wearing the white garment symbolic of the Muslim pilgrimage circled Islam's holiest site in Mecca Sunday after Saudi Arabia lifted coronavirus restrictions that had been in place for months. The kingdom had taken the rare step in early March of suspending the smaller year-round Umrah pilgrimages that draw millions from across the world as the coronavirus morphed into a global pandemic and prompted countries to impose lockdowns and curfews to slow down transmission. But as nations began to ease those restrictions, the Saudi government on Sunday started allowing a maximum of 6,000 pilgrims a day to enter the sprawling Grand Mosque in Mecca. Only Saudi citizens and residents will be permitted to enter the mosque during this first phase of reopening, and each person has up to 3 hours to complete their pilgrimage. And the French Open Women's Tournament got a shock Sunday when unseeded Polish youngster Iga Swiatek upset number one seed Simona Halep.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Once the impurities that have contaminated the sincerity of the COI are addressed, we as a party and politicians will never shy away from accounting for our stewardship.
Sierra Leone main opposition party, the All People's Congress or APC, condemns allegations of corruption against former President Ernest Bai Koroma.
We are going to use this time strategically so that we can reach people, so many people within and outside the country, as we have planned. So we have a plan B at our hand right now.
Leaders of the Tanzanian opposition Chadema accept the Electoral Commission's decision to impose a one-week campaign ban of the party's presidential candidate, Tundu Lissu.
He's parading as a prime minister because he knows that you have lost the trust on people who elected you to succeed the leader. Now you don't have the support base of the members of parliament, but we can still work with you, provided you leave this coalition.
And a Lesotho lawmaker calls on the prime minister to form a new coalition government with political parties willing to work with him. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma is scheduled to report to the offices of the Anti-Corruption Commission Monday to answer allegations of engaging in corruption during his term in office. This after a commission of inquiry compiled a report detailing corrupt activities perpetrated by officials of the former administration. A court subsequently barred the former president and over 100 officials of his government from traveling overseas. But supporters of the main opposition party vowed to legally challenge the allegations. They argue that the fight against corruption launched by the current government is aimed at persecuting officials of the former administration. For more reaction about the summons of the anti-graft agency and the court's order preventing the former president and his officials from traveling abroad, I reached Cornelius DeVoe, a spokesperson for the Sierra Leonean main opposition party, the All People's Congress, or APC.
As a party, we had at the onset of the commissions of inquiry raised issues pertaining to constitutional impurities which we believe will mar the outcome. The Supreme Court and the government failed to give a listening ear not only to our concerns but also concerns coming from other sectors, including the country's Bar Association. We believe that the outcomes of these commissions of inquiry is a missed opportunity to perfect the fight against corruption, which we started and sincerely pursued during our tenure.
But DeVoe, the government came up saying that the Commission of Inquiry's report presented to President Madabew detailed egregious corruption practices during President Koroma's administration. Don't you think some of these findings need to be thoroughly investigated?
Certainly, we will not shy away from the concept of accounting for our stewardship. However, we want to draw the attention of the wider citizenry and the international community to concerns coming from other persons who are non-political actors and institutions named in the report. Some are saying they were not consulted or given the opportunity to be heard. The local media and social media in Sierra Leone has been inundated with concerns and queries damning the report. So while it is true that accusations of egregious corruption should be investigated, we regret that the foundations of the COI remains faulty and the current government is to be blamed, which points to the fact that the whole idea of a commission of inquiry was simply intended to hoodwink their blind supporters, and it was not a genuine intent to continue the fight against corruption which we started and which we were very much applauded and acclaimed for.
But Devo, if officials of the former government are willing to account for their stewardship, then why accuse the current government of persecuting officials of your administration, particularly when he promised Sierra Leoneans that he is going to combat corruption and setting up a commission of inquiry to investigate activities of graft forms part of the effort to fight corruption? People say you should support this. What do you say to that?
The fight against corruption is a national crusade initiated by no less a person than former President Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma. And while in governance, we are on record to have arraigned our own functionaries on corruption-related issues. It was the hope of Sierra Leoneans that this current government will continue to plant its footsteps in ours with regards to the fight against corruption. Regrettably, recent perception surveys naming the presidency, the parliament, and the police as the most corrupt institutions in Sierra Leone, and failure of the current anti-corruption commission to deal squarely with allegations of corruption revolving around principles of this current administration indicates a serious disservice to the nation and a faulty line in this president's commitment to the fight against corruption. And like I said, once the impurities that have contaminated the sincerity of the COI are addressed, we as a party and politicians will never shy away from accounting for our stewardship.
Cornelius Devo is a spokesperson for the Sierra Leonean main opposition party, the All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In the Gambia, the Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC, has welcomed as a good development failure of a newly drafted constitution to pass the parliament. The party says a passage of the draft constitution could have plunged the West African country into crisis. The Gambians have been calling for a new constitution. This after rejecting the 1997 constitution adopted during former President Yahya Jammeh's rule. Critics say voters want a clean break from the former regime, but the newly drafted constitution called Bill 2020 failed to pass in parliament following strong opposition. The opposition APRC argues that provisions in the newly drafted measure failed to address issues surrounding citizenship. For more about the party's concerns regarding the failure of the newly drafted constitution, I reach Duduja, the Executive Secretary and Deputy Secretary of the Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, APRC.
For the very fact that the 1997 constitution, we believe it is better than this draft. In order to get rid of the 1997 constitution, they must give Gambians something that is better than it. Laws are not meant for a chosen few. It's for all of us. I believe the approach itself should have been a bottom-top approach. You cannot just create laws, you know, from top-bottom approach. For the elites, people that think they're educated, they should be in charge. Whilst the grassroots are the ones who empower them and give them their votes. So as such, we cannot just accept something that definitely does not suit Gambians as a nation.
Why does your party think this newly drafted constitution would have created a constitutional crisis in the Gambia?
Thank you, Mr. Peter. Your question is very, very relevant. If you look at the draft constitution, it talks about 50 plus 1 and emphasizes on second round of voting. The examples we took, it's like somebody who has about 36%, I'm just summarizing, We definitely not form the government of the day. We're going into second round. Now, going into second round, high chances are we might have two other candidates that might be level, you know, on the second. If they don't want to leave it for the other, both of them are contesting. Now, taking in this case, for example, in the first round, somebody has 36% but cannot be president. But in the second round, the likelihood is those that end up second could have even 35% and they will end up forming the government of the day. Whilst we are talking about 50 plus one, the Constitution does not explain briefly what would happen when we will be in such a situation. So that will definitely create crisis in any country.
The 1997 Constitution was drafted when President Yahya Jammeh was still the president, and many Gambians see it as a constitution for him. And therefore, since there's a new dispensation, there should be a new constitution. Why do you disagree?
Like you rightly mentioned, he was the president by then. That is factual. He was not among those who drafted the constitution. Neither did he dictate how the constitution was supposed to be drafted. And the constitution went to referendum whereby 70% or more of Gambians voted for that constitution to pass. Had it been the votes were less than what it required, then it would not have been a constitution. So I would say it was a constitution for Gambians because they voted for the draft to pass. And that he was not the one who drafted or dictated how the constitution was supposed to be drafted.
So, Duduja, what are the two main key issues you want the new draft constitution to have in order for you to be content for it to be passed in parliament to become the law of the land in the Gambia?
Some of the issues that we really expected to be in the draft is the issue of citizenship, especially when they went around consulting Gambians and have information from those that are about someone who worked with DCRC who said over 80% of Gambians have stated that whoever is born in this country should be a Gambian. I believe the consensus of the people or what majority have highlighted during the consultation, they should have accepted that because citizenship is very, very important and it should have been captured. If not, many have been rendered stateless based on the current laws of the Gambia. Another is about naturalization. If you look at the 97 Constitution, it states you have to be resident 15 years in this country and without any criminal or track record before you could naturalize. We suggested in one of the workshops whereby political parties were invited, we said let them register to 5 years. Somebody who's been resident in the Gambia for 5 years should definitely qualify for naturalization, taking into account they don't have criminal records or criminal track records. So these were key. The citizenship of a country definitely gives or empowers a nation, not when you render people stateless.
Duduja is the Executive Secretary and Deputy Secretary of the Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. Leaders of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, have decided to respect the decision of the Electoral Commission to ban its presidential candidate from campaigning for 1 week. This following a meeting of the party's leadership in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, Saturday. The Ethics Committee of the National Electoral Commission imposed a 1 week ban on Tundu Lissu, Chadema's presidential candidate. This after accusing the Electoral Commission of planning with the government to rig the elections in favor of incumbent President John Magufuli and his ruling party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi, or CCM. Mr. Lissu has also accused the Electoral Commission of bias and double standards. The Electoral Commission rejects the accusations as without merit. It insists it is applying the electoral laws equally without favor. To learn more about the decision of the Chadema leadership over the ban imposed on the party's presidential candidate, I reached John Rema, the opposition party's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols.
The National Executive Committee agreed that Tundu Lissu should not continue with his campaigns because if he will continue, the National Electoral Commission, they will even uplift more ban to him even till the day of election. So we've decided that Tundu Lissu will stay in Dar es Salaam. He will not go for the campaign, so that we will show them we respect that decision, although it was not a proper decision, but we respect it because we are advocating for the rule of law, we are advocating for the justice. And if the Electoral Commission thinks that by suspending Lissu, they are going to delay him from going various parts of the country, they are wrong.
What do you tell your supporters who are of the view that the ban placed on him was unfair because President John Magufuli has said that he's getting out of the campaign trail for about 1 week, and the ban was just to make sure he doesn't campaign while the president is taking a break, and that it is your constitutional duty to assemble or to speak? What is the message to them?
We knew this ban was calculated by the National Electoral Commission to make sure that when the President Magufuli is on his vacation, because they have announced that he will be on the vacation, they didn't want Tundu Lissu to continue with his campaign. It is unlawful, but if we want to respect that, we've gone through the procedures, the regulations. The regulation says that if you've been banned from doing campaigns and then you continue, they can assemble again and give you even more severe punishment. So we've calculated the risk of continuing or the risk of respecting even that decision was not proper. We thought that it is better we keep calm because that's what they need from us. They thought we are going to react. They thought we are going to continue so that they can get a reason even to ban him from doing campaigns until the day of election. So Tundu Lissu will be having several press conferences, several interviews with international media, because we are not sure if the local media they can air it out. So he'll be available for interviews. He'll be available to meet with people within the country, elder religious leaders, international community who are here. So they have opened another window of communicating to the public.
Some are suggesting that by banning him or preventing him from campaigning for a week, it will affect his electoral prospect, because the president is well known. He has a pedigree. He has the state resources at his disposal, and with the power of incumbency, that will make it difficult with the addition of the ban for 1 week for Tundu Lissu to challenge him in the presidential election. What is your reaction to that?
It is very true. That's why I say that this move was well calculated. They want him to delay his campaign rallies, but they are late, because Tundu Lissu is known country-wide since early 1990s. He has been advocating for human rights, rule of law, so everybody knows him. So by doing that, we will find a way of making sure that these 7 days, we are going to compensate them. And at the moment, the vice president, Salim Mwalim, will continue with his campaign. And also, we are going to compensate this by having another team of party leaders to go across the country, from Freeman Boyd and the Secretary General, to make sure that we compensate this loss of 7 days.
Now that you have strategically decided not to allow Tundu Lissu to campaign, but to accept the decision of the Electoral Commission's Ethics Committee, what's next for your party?
What is next is that we are going to continue with our campaigns. The vice president will continue with his rallies from tomorrow. Tomorrow he'll be in Zanzibar, and the day after tomorrow he'll be back in Dar es Salaam and continue with the mainland rallies. That's one. Secondly, we are going to use this time to meet with elder people of this country, religious leaders of this country, international community who are here, and communicate via international media to tell the world what is going on. So in one way, We are going to use this time strategically so that we can reach people, so many people within and outside the country, as we have planned. So we have a plan B at our hand right now.
John Rema is Chadema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Human rights activist says Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa's call for Southern African countries to organize future elections without the involvement of international observers to monitor the polls is regrettable. Zikamai Berry, the National Director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association's remark come after the Zimbabwean president says he wants members of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, a regional bloc, to organize elections without international poll observers for monitoring elections in the region. He says Malawi has shown the way for the rest of the region to follow by organizing a recent presidential poll rerun without the involvement of foreign poll observers. Critics say the president's statement means there will be no international poll observers in Zimbabwe's next election. They fear the polls will not be credible, an assertion supporters of the ruling party reject. For more reaction about the Zimbabwean president's statement about international poll observers, I reach Zikamai Berry, the national director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association.
While I appreciate the disappointment that our brothers and sisters in Malawi are going through because of election observers who gave a pass to a badly run election, I think saying we should do away with election observers is not the right approach. It is true that SADC has been a disappointment for many Africans across the region, and what we must ask for is reform of SADC so that SADC may show greater appreciation for democratic standards and solidarity with the people, not protectionism with the leaders.
But Zikamai, some Zimbabweans are saying what the president said is right, because Malawi held the presidential rerun without international poll observers, yet the results were credible, transparent, and fair, and that, they argue, could be replicated in the Southern African region. What are your thoughts?
I think there are many dynamics in the election that requires attention. First and foremost, we need to pay tribute to the institutions in Malawi that showed resilience and refused to be manipulated. So it's a cocktail of measures that delivered an election victory for the people of Malawi. And I don't think the solution is to reduce on mechanism and international mechanisms that are meant to help build democracy. They can only add to that. They are not the ones that are the main ingredient, I think, in terms of an election process. They're just one of many. With or without election observers, the internal democratic systems must be invested in.
But Zikamai, some Zimbabweans are expressing concern that the president's pronouncement could actually mean that there will be no international or foreign poll observers to monitor Zimbabwe's next election with this stance. Do you think their skepticism is legitimate?
These fears are genuine and legitimate because we have seen an increase in authoritarianism and solidarity to authoritarian tendencies in the SADC region. I would not be surprised if the Harare administration is going to take these words and use them to try and stop international observation of elections, which I think is a regression in terms of the democratic struggle. I think leaders have got an obligation to see beyond the emotions to trying to build our democracy. If you look at the reports that were produced by many observer missions who came to Zimbabwe, there are many positive suggestions which are currently being used by human rights advocates to try and push for electoral reforms. And that's why I think while the president's views are understandable, they are rather unfortunate and risk us regressing in terms of the democratic struggle.
Zikamai, as human rights defenders, I understand you often meet with civil society groups and opposition and government officials to try to figure out the best way to organize free, fair, transparent elections, not only in Zimbabwe, but in the Southern African region. What specific measures do you think need to be implemented by electoral bodies to ensure free, fair, transparent, and credible elections in specific countries or member countries of SADC?
I think a lot of investment needs to go into the pre-election environment, because it is in the pre-election environment where the culture is formed. First, I think there is need to invest in mechanisms for dispute resolution, because many disputes, even if an election is ultimately carried out and there is a winner, but the conflicts that emerge from the pre-election disputes are usually the ones responsible for violence in the aftermath.
Dikamai Bere is the National Director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the deputy chairman of Lesotho's governing or Basotho Congress, or ABC, is calling on Prime Minister Moeketsi Majoro to form a new coalition with political parties willing to work with him. Chalani Pori says the ABC's coalition partners have been poaching supporters of the party following the recent resignation of former Prime Minister Dr. Thomas Tabani, who was forced to resign after being implicated in the murder of his former estranged wife. Pori blames the coalition partners for having too much power in the decision to force the Prime Minister to resign, but critics say Pori is playing a dangerous game which could topple Prime Minister Majoro's government. They accused him of staging a publicity stunt to stay relevant in the party, an accusation he denies. To learn more about his call for the formation of a new coalition, I read Chalani Pori, deputy chairman of the Lesotho ruling party, the All Basotho Congress, or ABC.
I'm making sure that our partner is not becoming part of the current coalition. The reason being, when they first negotiated to form the coalition with my party, they said they don't want the leader of my party, which is Dr. Motsoaledi Tabani, to be part and parcel of the coalition that they are going to form. And then that pressurized our NEC, which is the National Executive Committee, to fall into that trap. After the NEC has agreed with them, now instead of seeing our support base growing, it's just decreasing in terms of number. And those people who are running away from the party, they are joining the DC. So the DC strategy was to divide us as the ABC by leaving behind our party so that they can penetrate into our support base.
By dropping your partner political party in this coalition, there could be unintended consequences in the fact that the current prime minister could lose his job, because you will not have the support that you need for him to stay in power. How do you resolve that?
Two things could happen here. If, because we don't want to leave the current prime minister when we get another coalition partner, what the prime minister could do is to reshuffle all the DC cabinet members and replace them with the other party that we are comfortable to work with. So that automatically will force DC to pull out of the coalition. But once the DC pulls out of the coalition, we shall be having the numbers required by the constitution to form the party with the inclusion of the new party that we'll be working with. That won't affect the party that much, because the numbers will still be there. But if he doesn't want to follow that, what we are going to do, we are going to make the vote of no confidence on the prime minister. By so doing, we want to topple the government. After we topple this government, we will form a new government with the current prime minister. Either with the current prime minister, or we can select anybody else from us.
Mr. Pori, some people are saying that is a dangerous game you are playing for a country that is seen as politically unstable in some instances. Don't you think so?
No, I don't mind whatever they say, but it's dangerous for the for the party. It's dangerous for their government, but it's dangerous for our party. You know, the party ABC, which is I'm the part of it, is the vehicle to form the government. Once we don't have this party, the way DC is taking our members to its side in the next 2022 elections, we are not going to be able to have the numbers that will form the government with anybody. So we have to rescue our party now. The strategy that they used to say, now let's separate the ABC by leaving behind the chairman of the NEC, which is the leader of the ABC. That is the greatest mistake that any political party would ever have in anywhere around the world. Because now everybody's laughing at us to say, where on earth would a leader of a certain party requested to leave to form a coalition government with another party, but that the political party leader is left aside?
Do you have a groundswell of support for this attempt to dissociate yourself with your coalition partner? And people are saying this is just a publicity stunt just to make yourself feel relevant in the party.
In this move that we are taking, I have convinced many MPs. We have the numbers. Let's wait for the 5th to come when the parliament is open. Once the parliament is open, we are going to move with that. But I have met with the prime minister. I showed the prime minister all these things. That the prime minister, you know what? You fell into this trap. Now these people are not listening to you. As a prime minister here, that your deputy being the leader of the DC is now that is. He's parading as a prime minister because he knows that you have lost the trust on people who elected you to succeed the leader. Now you don't have the support base of the members of parliament, but we can still work with you, provided you leave this coalition.
Chalani Pori is the deputy chairman of the Lesotho ruling party, the All Basotho Congress, or ABC. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Leaders of Sudan's transitional government and a number of rebel groups signed a peace agreement Saturday in the South Sudanese capital, Juba, which observers hope will put an end to nearly 2 decades of conflict in war-torn regions of the country, including Darfur. For VOA, Edward Uranian has more from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Sudan's interim president, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, captured the joyful mood surrounding the peace accord Saturday, chanting, "Sudan is our country and we are all brothers," to the large crowd gathered in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. He described the event with optimism. Burhan says that it is a great day for the destiny of Sudan's people, since the nation achieved the goal of a revolution, which is peace, after many years of war, putting a stop to bloodshed and giving the people a decent standard of living. Sudan's interim prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok, thanked all factions and leaders that joined the peace accord, ending his country's bloody 17-year conflict, and he urged the 2 remaining factions, which have not signed the peace deal, to come on board. He says that there could be no development without peace and no peace without fair and equitable development, all of which contribute to democracy. He adds that the country is waiting for the 2 rebel leaders who have not signed the accord, Abdelaziz Helu and Abdel Wahad Nour, to join it. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir, who oversaw months of difficult negotiations which led up to the August accord, told the crowd that he was delighted by the agreement and proud of the accomplishment, since South Sudan itself is still recovering from a long conflict. Kiir also thanked the international community for its support and encouragement in brokering the deal, insisting that our work is not done and we will not relax until our aspirations for a peaceful region are achieved. He warned the outside world that Sudan needs its help and aid. The leader of one of the factions which signed the joint peace deal, Arko Minawi, stressed that it was a step in the right direction. He says that sharing power during this interim period in Sudan will guarantee the rights of all and lead to a secure and lasting democracy in the future. The Sudanese Peace Accord includes 8 protocols and will restructure the country into 8 regions, replacing the country's current 18 provinces. The deal also includes a wealth-sharing provision, reparations for those hurt by the long conflict, and promises the return of refugees displaced by fighting. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Cameroon says more than 9 million girls aged 9 and above risk developing cervical cancer because their parents have been convinced the human papilloma virus or HPV vaccine makes their daughters sterile. Some communities that had accepted the vaccination are now refusing it, claiming that what is being administered now are dangerous experimental COVID-19 vaccines. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital Yaoundé that the government, doctors, and female medical staff members are working to convince parents the HPV vaccination reduces the risk of cervical cancer.
Groups of 20 young women move from market to market and through popular spots in Cameroon capital Yaoundé. They share posters and tell Cameroonians that the HPV vaccine does not make girls sterile. Among them is Linda Fonyui, a 21-year-old mother.
I, for instance, am giving my testimony that I received my vaccine as far back as 2014, and today I'm a mother of 2.
40-year-old fruit seller Gloria Amana says she is not convinced by Fonyui.
Tout n'est pas clair parce que il y a assez de rumeurs.
She says she will not accept HPV vaccine because a lot of negative information about the vaccine has been circulating on social media platforms. She says she wants to be a grandmother, so she rejects any vaccine that would sterilize her daughter. This month, Cameroon is implementing systematic use of the HPV vaccine. The effort was first launched in 2014 and has been in a demonstration phase since. The government and organizations such as the Cameroon Medical Women Association organized the nationwide campaign to convince parents the HPV vaccine protects their children from cervical cancer. Celine Marisugu, coordinator of Cameroon's expanded vaccination program on the country's northern border with Nigeria, says much controversy has been generated about the vaccine since Cameroon reported its first coronavirus case in March.
La gratuité ne veut pas dire que c'est mauvais. La gratuité, c'est parce que l'État pensait que...
She says the first reason the vaccine has been controversial is that it is free. She says the vaccine is free because the government wants to reduce the incidence of cervical cancer among its citizens and that people should stop claiming that it is not an HPV vaccine, but anti-COVID-19 vaccines Western countries have paid to test in Cameroon. She says the vaccine is given at the age of 9 before a girl's first sexual encounter when the virus that causes cervical cancer can be contracted. Rose Leke, Professor Emeritus of Immunology at the University of Yaoundé, says the controversy reached its apex when, in a television discussion last April, 2 French doctors, one of them the head of an intensive care unit in Paris, suggested trials for vaccines against COVID-19 should be conducted in Africa. Leke says the HPV vaccine has nothing in common with what the French doctors proposed.
Everybody should know that the government is working with UNICEF, and what comes in here, I can assure you, it's of good quality. People should ask themselves, which government will go on to destroy its own people? So people should get that trust. And I think the heads of the communes and so on should also be responsible to take correct messages down to the communities.
The government and its health partners say they are combating the coronavirus, but not neglecting other life-threatening diseases. The government is asking organizations, lawmakers, and medical staff members to convince people that vaccinations protect them and that no vaccine is intended to kill or to make girls sterile. Cameroon's expanded vaccination program says 1,500 women in the Central African state die each year of cervical cancer. About 11 million are targeted for vaccination starting this month. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says HPV vaccination is recommended for 11 and 12-year-old girls. It is also recommended for girls and women aged 13 through 26 years old who have not yet been vaccinated or completed the vaccine series. The center says the vaccine can also be given to girls beginning at age 9 to protect against cancers caused by HPV. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin at the London Marathon 2020. Ethiopian Shura Kitata has won the men's title after a thrilling sprint finish. Kitata's winning time was 2 hours, 5 minutes and 41 seconds, a second ahead of Kenyan Vincent Kichumba. World record holder Eliud Kipchoge struggled and finished 8th, crossing the finish line in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 39 seconds. Another Ethiopian, Cisse Lema, came in 3rd, while Mosenet Geremew was 4th. In the women's event, world record holder Brigid Kosgei retained her London Marathon title with a commanding performance. The 26-year-old Kenyan, who broke Paula Radcliffe's world record in Chicago last year, went clear of world champion Ruth Cheptengetich after mile 18. She finished 2 hours, 18 minutes and 58 seconds to claim the $30,000 prize. Cheptengetich was beaten second place by American Sarah Hall. Hall, who has promised to donate her winnings to children's charities for her adopted children's native Ethiopia, sprinted clear in the final few hundred meters. In football, the Bureau of the FIFA Council has approved international match protocol and adapted rules on release of players. In light of the current evolution of the COVID-19 pandemic, FIFA has, in line with the recommendations issued by the World Health Organization, issued a Return to Football International Match Protocol that defines a set of preventive measures to be implemented in the footprint of matches and all official sites, such as strict monitoring and testing of players, delegates and officials, and hand hygiene, among others. Since the protocol will be implemented for the FIFA World Cup 2022 qualifiers, the relevant competition regulations have been amended accordingly. The amendments include the ability for participating teams to use up to 5 substitutes during matches. Also, new players can now switch the national team if they have played no more than 3 matches for a nation at senior level, with all the appearances coming before the player turns 21. Morocco has taken advantage of this rule to include Munil Al-Haddadi in their squad. The old regulations prevented the 25-year-old forward from playing for the Atlas Lions, as he has earned a competitive cup for Spain. Morocco has 2 friendlies during the upcoming international break, firstly with Senegal on October 9th, and DR Congo 4 days later. Morocco is preparing for November's back-to-back Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers against the Central African Republic. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Baba. upando siwezi, I want you kabisa sijiwezi niseme tu yani nipo kama ndezi mikono juu.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English Service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, dawn doesn't come twice to wake a person up. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.